I thought because we lost a great spiritual being in this last week, Thich Nhat Hanh, that we could just take a moment of silence to remember him and all the amazing work that he did over the years, the selfless personality that he was, the humility that he lived his life with, and the kindness and cheerfulness with which he expressed himself and led his students. And I would like also to remember Sherry and your son, Sherry, and any others that come to your mind who are beings that have left us, and wish them well on their way. Let's just take a moment of silence. So, how do we make choices when we're faced with apparent opposites? Is there a reasonable and ethical way to discern the pros and cons of a situation and come to logical decisions in which the heart, the mind, and the soul are at peace, regardless of the circumstances and consequences? Let's start out by looking at how not to make choices. When I was in seminary, I think in my first year, I was in a philosophy class, and the professor suggested that we read this book, Unjust War. And after the class, one of my classmates said to me, "Oh, I know this guy. One of my friends is in his class." And she said, "He has fits of temper, and sometimes he throws books at students." And I said, "I'm not going to read that book. If he throws books at students, I'm not going to read his book." And so I chose the hearsay of a friend over the wisdom of the professor. I never did read the book. I lost the messages of the book, and I never got the message of the situation. This black and white thinking is a lot of what we're seeing amongst people who can't give up the Trump presidency, or who, like my neighbor Steve, whose wife was in the hospital with COVID this week, when I asked him if he was vaccinated, he said no. And I said, "Why, Steve?" And he said, "I just don't like people shoving something down my throat." Well, this is a guy who was in the military. He took all those shots that he was required to have in the military, and there was no pandemic in those days. Young children often think in black and white. "It's mine. You can't have it." People who have not traveled outside of their place of upbringing, or have a low level of education, or have parents who teach them to think in black and white, right or wrong, are inclined to think in opposites and have difficulty in reconciling differences. So if that's an example of failure to reconcile options, here are a couple of outstanding leaders facing difficult and consequential choices in fragile and dangerous political times. Some of you will know that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran minister and professor of religion who, through most of the Second World War, refused to join in plots to kill Hitler, but he did preach against what was going on. Imagine the moral dilemma he found himself in, being a pacifist on one hand and observing the vile acts of the Hitler regime and knowing that he had the power to effect change. In his book, The Cost of Discipleship, he writes about the Sermon on the Mount, in which he not only attacked cheap grace as a cover for ethical laxity, but also preached costly grace. In order to shelter him from the dangers of one who had preached against Hitler, he was offered a professorship in the U.S., and indeed, he did go there. But just a couple of weeks after coming to the U.S., amid much inner turmoil, he wrote to his friend and fellow theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr, "I've come to the conclusion that I must live through this difficult period in our national history with the people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people, Christians in Germany will have to face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice from security. You see, he looked at that as cheap grace, staying in the U.S. So Bonhoeffer returned to Germany, aware of the moral danger that he was putting himself in. He rightly names the moral dilemma and decides which side to come down on. Behavior consistent with his values. Back in Germany, in the face of the Nazi atrocities, Bonhoeffer stretched his moral compass and joined a plot to kill Hitler, which sadly was unsuccessful, and he was imprisoned nevertheless. During this time of incarceration is when he wrote The Cost of Discipleship, in which he said of his actions, "The ultimate question for a responsible man is not to ask how he is to extricate himself heroically from the affair," as in going to the U.S., "but how the coming generation shall continue to live," which is what he based his decision to return on. He did not justify his action, but he accepted that he was taking guilt upon himself for becoming part of this plot. When a man takes guilt upon himself in responsibility, he imputes his guilt to himself and no one else. He answers for it. Before other men, he is justified by dire necessity. Before himself, he is acquitted by his conscience. And before God, he hopes only for grace. This is the voice of a true leader. But sadly, very shortly before the end of the war, he was hanged for his part in the plot. Nevertheless, his legacy of courage, clearly reasoning, and faith in his moral rectitude lives on as an example for others. Bonhoeffer was at peace with his decision to return to Germany, and we've been gifted with this wonderful book that he wrote. Although he accepted his guilt, he never quite came to terms with having chosen the possibility of killing another human being. Closer to our own times, Bill Moyer in 2008 wrote, "To take a stand, we must prepare thoroughly and be aware of our own biases, which can cloud our judgment." That's the reason I did not label Trump in his first 2 years of office. For the past 2 years under President Trump, and not in his first 2 years of office, I have referred to him as a racist and sexist. Now I call him an American fascist who attempted a coup to stay in power and overthrow democracy. It is our duty as journalists to be honest purveyors of information, to tell as close to the truth as humanly possible. And when the facts are abundantly clear, there are times we have to take a stand on an issue in order to do that. So January 6th is one of those issues, and this is one of those times. Moyers understood his propensity to speak the truth to power could cost him jobs. And in fact, he was laid off 11 times during his broadcast journalism time. He estimates four of those times were for reporting the truth. Hard choices. But despite and perhaps because of those layoffs and the choices that he made, we as his listeners trusted him to tell the truth as he saw it. What of us mere mortals when we have to make choices? We too need to examine ourselves and know the truth within us, to tell it to ourselves and to others to the best of our abilities. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Brené Brown, noted sociologist and author, has written several books. One of the best known, The Gifts of Imperfection, subtitled Let Go of Who You Think You're Supposed to Be and Embrace Who You Are. She counsels people to be awkward, brave, and kind. God knows we could use more of that in this world today, in ourselves and in others. There's a kind of imbalance that we have control over and can resolve even long after the original story. Shankar is the protagonist in a book, Night Jasmine Tree, a story of an Indian man who grows up in a very conservative Brahmin family in India. But when he tells his father that he has fallen in love with and wants to marry a woman of a lower caste, his father, in a rage, throws him out of the house and disowns him as his son. Shankar decides he will never think of his family again and he will never return to Calcutta, and marries the woman, and they move to the United States to establish a new life together. For some 30 years, he's very busy as a university professor and he doesn't think of his family. He pushes those thoughts down. But finally, the separation overcomes him when he receives a letter from his sister, who is dying. He knows nothing of his sister's lives. He didn't even open a letter that she sent him years before. And as the only son, he has not given his parents the required burial rites. Shankar thinks of the Buddha's teachings. The way to end your suffering is through loving kindness, compassion, and awakening one's mind. And compassion cannot rise when one is angry. He thinks of how long he's been angry with his father and felt remorse and sympathy rising in his heart. His anger and his vow to himself to shut out the past, including his family, made his life smaller and deprived his son and grandchildren of their family. Through the stories he told of his grandchildren, the letter from his sister, and the teachings of the Buddha, he was finally able to break through that wall that he had created to be free. He returned to India, got medical assistance for his sister, and she recovered. And he did the proper burial rites for his parents, assuaging his guilt. He gave his son and his grandchildren the gift of his family and his heritage, and finally discovered peace. How many of us have made covenants with ourselves about things that happened to us long ago that we would never allow to happen before? Covenants which we have not examined as adults, and perhaps changed our minds about. Our lives would be so much more peaceful if we could reconcile those differences within us. There's another kind of tension of opposite realities over which we have little or no control. Sometimes we don't have a choice of whether we should do one thing or another. The only choice we have is how to live in the situation that we have with the best possible attitude to change our relationship to the situation. Lisa is a 76-year-old woman who was an airline stewardess. She married Ross, had a son, got rheumatoid arthritis after her son was born, and now she cares for a husband with Parkinson's. Ross was a chef, a poet, a songwriter, a bicyclist. He got early onset Parkinson's after a bike accident on Chuckanut Drive and now suffers extreme anxiety from time to time, inability to play his guitar and sing, occasional loss of muscle control resulting in falls. He also is very intelligent, and when he's feeling good, he has a great sense of humor. His poetry is exquisite, and he's published 3 books. He's also written some beautiful music. Ross could sit at home feeling sorry for himself, but he works hard to find things that he enjoys and can be grateful for. For example, the reception his poetry gets when he shares it, spin cycling at the Y, interpretive dance for people with Parkinson's put on by a woman from Western, running on the track at the high school, and outings in nature. I remember the day about 15 years ago when Lisa said in a women's group, "I can't do this." This being the long haul of watching her husband leaving her little by little and becoming his caregiver. She knew what was ahead. Now she teaches Tai Chi and Qigong, belongs to a women's group, meditates with a group online 5 days a week, swims weekly, and attends a Parky Partners group to keep herself healthy. She cares for her husband with grace and wisdom. She has learned to go with the flow and to maximize the good times and be patient with him when he's in the depths of depression. You might have read Michael J. Fox's article in the most recent issue of ARP, where he describes his Parkinson's as the thing that's attached to my life, but it isn't the driver. He notes that after a particularly dark time in his life, he recognized that gratitude was the answer. He says it makes optimism sustainable. And furthermore, he says, you don't just receive optimism. You've got to behave in a way that promotes it. We can all learn from that. Lisa and Ross have adjusted their attitudes as his disease has progressed. Not that it's all easy, but in general, they have been admirable in the ways that they have embraced gratitude and the large and small opportunities for celebrating who and what they are. Let me close with a poignant and beautiful love story. Susan Hurst was a beautiful, vigorous, intelligent volunteer for the Red Cross, gardener, and one of my companions on two working trips to Ghana. 5 years ago, she helped me dig a hole to plant a tree because I had bronchitis and she thought she was healthy. And she was going to come back the next week to help me again in the garden. But she called and said, I'm supposed to go to Spain with my grandson on Monday. And I've got a bit of a cold and I think I better not go. Monday came and they canceled the plane. Tuesday came and they canceled the plane. On Wednesday, the whole family decided instead to go to Utah to hike. But when they got there, Susan couldn't figure out how to do up her seatbelt, and she began dropping things. And her husband said, we're going home. So they returned to Bellingham, and the next day got the diagnosis that Susan had lung cancer, which had metastasized to her brain, stage 4. In 2 weeks, Susan was dead. Just a shocking experience for the whole family. But really, a beautiful death, because she told me on Monday, all I want is for my family to be around, and they all were. It was quite lovely. And she never had any pain. Well, a couple of years later, Eric began to search for another partner and found Lori. And now they've been together for 2 years. I met Eric recently walking around Lake Padden and asked how he was doing. And he said to me, I miss Susan terribly every day. And I love Lori so much. She's given me so much joy. In a way, it took my breath away. And yet, has he not found the perfect balance between opposites? May we all rise in the vicissitudes of our own lives and find our own directions with equanimity, embracing what is, and finding joy and meaning where we can. Amen, and blessed be.